Ora, ora.
Hello, I'm Hanea Ahu, bringing you the week in Parliament with Tom Fruin and Rhys Lyon. Two tribes go to war, the government and the opposition, at war on Tuesday over the Cabinet's decision to join the war in Iraq. That decision, on the card since last September, was formally conveyed to Parliament by the Prime Minister, John Key, in a ministerial statement when MPs gathered in the chamber to start the week at 2 p.m. on Tuesday.
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, I wish to make a ministerial statement under Standing Order 356 in relation to the deployment of troops to Iraq. Mr Speaker, today I'm announcing to the House the government's decision about our contribution to the fight against the Islamic State of Iraq and Levant, or ISIL. Last November, I gave a national security speech which outlined the threat posed to New Zealand by ISIL. This brutal group and its distressing methods deserve the strongest condemnation. ISIL's ability to motivate Islamic radicals make it a threat not only to the stability in the Middle East, but regionally and locally too. It is well-funded and highly skilled at using the internet to recruit. Disturbingly, if anything, ISIL's brutality has worsened since I gave that speech late last year. In recent weeks, we have witnessed a mass beheading and the horrific plight of a Jordanian pilot being burned alive in a cage. And we've seen stories of Western hostages who have been kidnapped and killed in barbaric ways. ISIL's outrageous actions have united an international coalition of 62 countries against this group. New Zealand is already considered part of the coalition, because we have made humanitarian contributions with $14.5 million in aid provided to the region so far. The government has carefully considered its options to expand our contribution to the international coalition. As I outlined in November, our approach is one that addresses humanitarian, diplomatic, intelligence and capacity-building issues. Mr Speaker, New Zealand is a country that stands up for its values. We stand up for what is right. We have an obligation to support stability and the rule of law internationally. We do not shy away from taking our share of the burden when the international rules-based system is threatened as it is today.
A ministerial statement, such as that one from the Prime Minister, automatically triggers a round of responses from party leaders. On Tuesday, though, deals had been done behind the scenes to allow more contributions.
I seek leave for the statement to be up to 10 minutes, for there to be comments of up to 10 minutes, each as follows: 2 from National, 3 from Labor, 2 from the Green Party, 2 from New Zealand First, 1 each from the Māori Party, United Future and ACT, and for the Prime Minister to speak in reply for up to 5 minutes.
The Leader of the House, Jerry Brownlee. And for how that debate unfolded, here's Tom Fruin.
A week may be a long time in politics, but it's only 3 days in Parliament, where words speak louder than actions, but the final word is a number, 61. That's the number of votes required for a majority in this Parliament, elected last September, with 121 seats. The total currently down by one until the vacancy in the Northland seat, created by the resignation of National's Mike Sabin, is filled by the winner of a by-election late in March. So barely a week, but just 2 sitting days after winning the confidence vote that ended the debate on the Prime Minister's statement by 63 votes to 57, John Key's National-led government declined the opposition's challenge when Parliament resumed at 2 on Tuesday to test support in the chamber for the Cabinet's decision to send nearly 150 military personnel to train Iraqi soldiers for the war against Islamic State. That decision was announced by Mr Key in a ministerial statement, which triggered a round of speeches from party leaders and defence spokesmen, including Labour's Phil Goff.
This decision is being made in the House today without a vote. Without a vote, because there is no majority in this House to support the deployment of troops to Iraq.
Mr Goff went further, hinting at dissension in National's caucus.
In fact, if there was a conscience vote on the National side, there would be a minority in this House in favour of deployment, because that decision in the National caucus was not a unanimous one.
Phil Goff's speculation that the troop deployment had only minority support in the chamber could not be tested after the government blocked two opposition calls for a vote. But it was soon apparent that the parties bound to vote with National on confidence and supply were not prepared to give the government the two extra votes needed for a bare majority of 61 on Tuesday. The Māori Party's co-leader, Tu Ururu Flavel, was not about to cast his party's two votes behind the deployment.
Sir, Aotearoa has much to contribute to eliminating the threat of ISIS, but it is not by sending troops, sending our military personnel into Te Mura o Te Ahi.
The battlefront. United Futures Peter Dunn said New Zealand should first be seeking international support.
We should be using our role on the Security Council to first of all insist that any action that takes place against ISIL is UN mandated, and this is not.
And even National's staunchest ally, the ACT Party's David Seymour, had doubts.
I have considerable scepticism about what intervention in such a theatre can achieve.
Across the chamber, New Zealand First Leader Winston Peters was clear about his party's position.
My party would have preferred from New Zealand First that Parliament gave them a mandate, so putting their lives at risk for our country and for the sake of peace came with the support of all the New Zealand people, not just an arrogant government making a minority decision.
A decision scorned by Greens co-leader Russell Norman.
We're going to supposedly defend democracy in the Middle East, but the National Party government has just now prevented Parliament from voting on whether New Zealand should go to war. Democracy, it seems, is a military export and is not for domestic consumption.
And leading the opposition's response to the Prime Minister's call to arms, Labour leader Andrew Little said there were better ways of helping war-torn countries like Iraq.
Rebuild their economies, rebuild their communities, and give themselves the confidence and the means to repel the evil that is represented by Islamic State. We've turned our back on that option. We are opposed to sending troops to Iraq.
To which Prime Minister John Key had this response.
Mr Speaker, I will not... stand by. Well, Jordanian pilots are burnt to death when kids execute soldiers, when people are out there being beheaded. I'm sorry, but this is the time to stand up and be counted. Get some guts and join the right side. Get some guts.
John Key's call for the opposition to get some guts ricocheted around the chamber, winding up in this complaint to the Speaker from Mr Little.
Prime Minister, in the heat of his presentation yesterday, got away with alleging or implying that members of the opposition didn't have guts or didn't have courage. But to say it explicitly is against standing orders, and I invite you, Mr Speaker, to call him to account.
Order. Order.
The Speaker was not convinced.
The comments made yesterday were certainly robust. I don't think they were out of order.
That was on Wednesday when MPs had their first chance this year to make some progress on their bills, with voting on one of them producing this rare dead heat.
Members, the ayes are 60, the noes are 60, the motion is lost.
Deputy Speaker Chester Burrows announcing the result of the vote on the third reading of the Parental Leave and Employment Protection 6 months Paid Leave Amendment Bill in the name of Labour's Sue Moroney.
Mr Speaker.
Sue Moroney.
I move that the Parental Leave and Employment Protection 6 months Paid Leave Amendment Bill be now read a third time. Mr Speaker, I thought I would never, ever get to say those words, because what a wild ride this has been.
Drawn from the ballot almost 3 years ago in April 2012, with the aim of increasing paid parental leave to 26 weeks, Sue Moroney's bill passed its first reading the following July by just one vote, supported by all parties except National and ACT, and getting its one vote margin from United Futures' Peter Dunn. It was sent to a select committee where it attracted 3,800 submissions, 99.6% of them in favour. Back in the chamber for a second reading in May last year, it survived by the same one-vote margin, with National and ACT saying it was unaffordable and the Finance Minister threatening a financial veto if it got to a third reading. Next, the Bills Committee stage, where amendments are made, was interrupted by the general election in September. That gave National one more seat and a majority of one, which it used to gut the bill of everything but its title. Then Nationals Northland MP Mike Sabin resigned, creating the potential for that rare dared heat when Sue Moroney tried to restore the bill's purpose by having it sent back into its committee stage. The result this time announced by Assistant Speaker Trevor Mallard.
The ayes are 60, the noes are 60, the motion is not agreed to.
With that, the third reading began and the House engaged in a frequently bad-tempered debate on the merits of Sue Moroney's bill, with this from her caucus colleague, Eilise Galloway, as some consolation for her defeat.
If it wasn't for Sue Moroney and if it wasn't for her bill, absolutely nothing would be being done about paid parental leave. That government would not have done a thing to extend paid parental leave if it had not been for Sue Moroney.
While Sue Moroney's bill was joined in the bin by two other members' bills on Wednesday night, the government got two of its bills, the Gambling Amendment Bill No. 2 and the Parole Amendment Bill, through their third and final stages. While its exclusive economic zone and continental shelf, environmental effects in brackets, open new brackets, transitional provisions, close brackets amendment bill, had its first reading and was sent to the Local Government and Environment Committee to be reported back by Monday, June the 29th. Now, for more from the committee rooms, here's Rhys Lyon.
An historic moment in the Social Services Committee on Wednesday, as two heads of state, the Prime Minister of the Cook Islands and Premier of Niue, sat side by side to make a submission on the social assistance portability to Cook Islands, Niue and Tokelau Bill. The bill seeks to allow eligible residents of the realm countries, including the Cook Islands, Niue and Tokelau, to apply from the islands for their superannuation, exempting them from the requirement to be ordinarily resident and present in New Zealand to do so. First to speak at the committee meeting was Cook Islands Prime Minister Henry Puna.
The realm is now characterised by accelerated rates of population flows to New Zealand. To a large degree, New Zealand has been the focus and the pivot for our residents to travel further afield. The consequences are that we must turn our attention now to how mobility can be better analysed and managed to serve the interests of us all the members of the realm. Mr. Chairman, honourable members, the Cook Islands is therefore more than willing to work closely and collaboratively with New Zealand on how we can address the imbalances and alleviate the pressures of accelerated population drift. The governments of both countries have talked about this as a priority for many years, but I believe there is a real commitment now to do what we can. In this instance, we may appear to be just talking about our aged, our middle-aged and older. That would be too simplistic. The context is our struggle over population trends and the sustainability of our countries. The question is about the future and having the capacity to build that future. Truth be told, we cannot compete with New Zealand, but we are forced to, Mr. Chairman. Despite our efforts to improve working conditions, we're currently struggling with the prospect of raising the minimum wage in order to provide incentives for our people to stay home and not move to New Zealand or Australia. Qualifying for the New Zealand Super is a highly regarded and valued option for many Cook Islanders and realm residents, particularly those who have made the commitment to live and to work in New Zealand for decades. They have a strong sense of loyalty, but the demands of the criteria threaten that sense of loyalty. The requirements, in fact, present a double-edged disadvantage for New Zealanders. Cook Islanders resident in New Zealand are discouraged from returning home and contributing to our development until they reach at least 55 years of age. And if returning home after 10 years, the portable pension for them is reduced by 50%. Portability was supposed to help entice the older generations to return home. but the present conditions provide a reduced incentive for us as members of the realm. There is no such recognition of the realm when the Cook Islands, Niue and Tokelau are subject to a catch-all basket which can remove 50% of your entitlement. Presently, Mr. Chairman, we have a lot of difficulty attracting the younger ones home because they know they'll have to go back to New Zealand at some stage after turning 50. Those who have moved home before the age of 50 or since turning 50 quite understandably feel punished, especially those who have worked for 20 or even 30 years. Essentially, they are being told to sacrifice any sense of loyalty they may have had. Honourable members of the committee, there is no equity when a resident of New Zealand can satisfy a requirement with a minimum of 10 years compared with someone who has served for 30 years but not met the 5 years above the age of 50. Conversely, many Cook Islands residents are being forced to move to New Zealand to meet the 5-year requirement at an age when they are being most productive at home and most certainly less productive when they come to New Zealand. Cook Islands residents over the age of 50 are business owners, they're senior civil servants and managers, community and cultural leaders. Sadly, these people are being uprooted from their responsibilities and their productivity by being forced to come back for 5 years. Jobs are left, homes are left, family are left behind. Mr. Chairman, the costs run broad and deep in a small country. If Cook Islanders were free from the conditions and requirements and allowed to continue residing at home, they would strengthen our capacity for sustainable development. They would contribute to the stability of our growth. They would add value to our community base, and they would improve our national well-being. In fact, any costs associated with these requested changes, Mr. Chairman, would flow back to New Zealand in the form of trade revenue, the balance of which, as honourable committee members will be well aware, it's hugely in favour of New Zealand by about $300 million and increasing. In addition, amendments to allow Cook Islanders to continue residing at home would be consistent with other New Zealand commitments. It would be consistent with other requirements for New Zealanders who reside in countries outside of the realm. And it would be consistent with a requirement placed upon applicants for New Zealand citizenship. One of several requirements for those applying for New Zealand citizenship is residency within the realm country for a period of 5 years. If New Zealand accepted the 5-year residency in a realm country as one fulfillment to attain citizenship, Mr. Chairman, the same principle could be applied to accept a 5-year residency in a realm country to help fulfill obligations for the New Zealand Super. Mr. Chairman, honourable members, the Cook Islands submits a case based on equity, on national capacity building, and on sustainability. And it does so as citizens of equal rights and purpose in the spirit of the realm and its obligations.
Cook Islands Prime Minister Henry Puna making that submission on the Social Assistance Portability to Cook Islands, Niue and Tokelau Bill to the Social Services Committee. And elsewhere on Wednesday, the Government Administration Committee held the annual financial review of the Museum of New Zealand Te Papa, whose chairman, Evan Williams, was called on to explain a more than $8 million financial deficit in the 2013-14 year. Along with accounting issues and cost increases, Evan Williams said a couple of the museum's exhibitions had also lost money.
Two exhibitions in that year lost $2 million, or just on $2 million between them. They were called Colour and Light, an exhibition from the United States of Impressionist paintings, and what's the other exhibition?
Aztecs.
Between the two of them, visitor numbers were forecast at about 100,000 apiece, and they performed at about 40,000 and 50,000 respectively. They produced a loss of about 900,000 each.
And Te Papa Chief Executive Rick Ellis also chimed in, drawing on his experience as the former head of TVNZ.
At the end of the day, these exhibitions in many respects are like the launch of a new TV series, dare I go there. They don't always achieve the rating success that one hoped and wished they would.
Te Papa Chief Executive Rick Ellis speaking to the Government Administration Committee on Wednesday. Next day in the Commerce Committee, taxpayer dollars spent on the X Factor New Zealand television show was the subject of opposition questions to New Zealand On Air bosses when they fronted up for their annual financial review. Questions from Labour's Claire Curran about the value for taxpayers in funding the X Factor talent show were answered by NZ On Air chairwoman Miriam Dean.
For a good number of reasons, it wouldn't have got to air otherwise. And what does it do? It nurtures some wonderful New Zealand music talent.
Wonderful New Zealand music talent, such as...
And Bernard, what was his name?
Bene Tiffany,
or whatever, who was only a short, one of the finalists, I think, as you know, topped our music charts for the last couple of years. We found some great New Zealand music talent through that show.
Claire Curran also asked Ms. Dean about a recent controversy surrounding one of the show's contestants who had a criminal past. Ms. Dean said it was not up to New Zealand On Air to judge the suitability of individual X Factor contestants.
It is not for us to decide on who the musicians are that come forward, who gets judged to go to boot camp. That is obviously for the so-called panel.
And alongside Miriam Dean was New Zealand On Air Chief Executive Jane Wrightson.
If you're worried about the financial side of it, then of course the artists don't get any money, so no taxpayer money is supporting this man. And secondly, he will stand or fall on his musical talent, and that's the point of the show.
New Zealand On Air Chief Executive Jane Wrightson speaking to the Commerce Committee on Thursday. All up, there were 15 committee meetings held during the week.
That report from Rhys Lyon. Back in the chamber, the House held its first general debate for the year on Wednesday, with Labour's David Parker using some of his 5 minutes to read a transcript of the Prime Minister's replies to reporters' questions about a fundraising dinner at the home of Dong Wai Liu.
Now, you misleading by omission, the reporter asks. PM, no. I mean, look, at the end of the day, we're never going to start getting into a process of saying where we had dinner. Next, he said, I knew it was a Cabinet Club dinner. And the reporter says, just to be clear, last year your office denied the dinner was a Cabinet Club dinner. Emphatically, they said no. PM, right. Reporter, you're saying it was a Cabinet Club dinner. PM. Well, that's only what I read in the paper in the weekend. People have their own definitions of it. Reporter, so to be clear, was it a Cabinet Club dinner? PM. I don't know. You'd have to ask Jamie Lee Ross. He organised it. Reporter, but didn't you say it was a Cabinet Club dinner? PM. Well, like I say. Reporter, how do you define a Cabinet Club dinner? PM. Well, that's right. How do you? Reporter, well, we don't go to them. It gets worse. It goes, reporting, so you seem to be contradicting your office, who emphatically said it was not a Cabinet Club dinner. PM, well, probably it wasn't then. I don't know. I don't know the details. Reporter, but just moments ago you said it was a Cabinet Club dinner. PM, well, only because that's what I read in the paper. If you're telling me it wasn't, then it wasn't. Reporter, but you were there. Mr Speaker.
Labour's David Parker reading a transcript of a press conference, or media stand-up as they're now called, with the Prime Minister John Key, which makes it a good time for the Mystery Voice.
The Week in Parliament, Mystery Voice.
My question is to the Minister for Courts.
how successful has the government's new driver's licence stop orders initiative been in collecting unpaid traffic fines during its first year?
Who is the mystery voice and what are they talking about? Here he is again.
My question is to the Minister for Courts. How successful has the government's new driver's licence stop orders initiative been in collecting unpaid traffic fines during its first year?
I'll be back with the identity of the mystery voice later in the programme. First, though, drought in the South Island and pestilence in the North had Primary Industries Minister Nathan Guy on his feet answering opposition questions on Thursday.
Mr. Speaker, the government has made an extra $200,000 available to localised rural support trusts who provide advice, coordination and provide emotional support. Rural assistance payments are also available from Work and Income, and assistance from Inland Revenue will give greater flexibility to affected farmers and growers around their tax obligations.
Then a question for Nathan Guy from his Labor shadow, Damien O'Connor.
Why won't the Minister provide the support that farmers and growers have been asking for in report after report, and that is more resource for a better bioprotection system?
Honourable Nathan Guy.
Well, we are, Mr. Speaker. We are, and industry knows that. Industry were very worried at the last election that the Labor Party could have been sitting on this side of the House on the Treasury benches because they knew that they didn't. You didn't support irrigation. You didn't support
order,
biological...
Order.
The Speaker reminded Mr. Guy that in the Chamber, you means him, the Speaker, and he can't be dragged into the debate. The Minister was soon back on his feet, answering another question from Mr. O'Connor about a new threat at the border.
Mr. Speaker, how have the 13 brown marmorated stink bugs entered New Zealand? And can he assure New Zealanders that a population hasn't been established, which will cost the country billions of dollars?
Order. Honourable Nathan Guy.
Mr. Speaker, no, I can't confirm that, but what I can confirm is there has been a population explosion in the US. MPI are reviewing all the import health standards. They're looking at chemical eradication in particular for products that are coming into the border. We are extremely aware of this pest and the ramifications it could have on the horticulture industry. That's why biosecurity will always be my number one priority.
Nathan Guy rejected Damien O'Connor's call for his resignation.
We can't take anything this member takes seriously. Last year when we had a fruit fly find in Whangarei, this member came out and said we should ban all imports of fruit and vegetables from Australia. Not even the industry was calling for that. Do you know what that would have meant? The price of bananas would have gone up. We could have had trade ramifications from the Australians. This member is completely out of touch.
Primary Industries Minister and MP for Ōtaki, Nathan Guy, answering questions on Thursday. And before we hear the mystery voice again, here's a clue. He's one of Nathan Guy's close neighbours and is in the same party.
My question is to the Minister for Courts. How successful has the government's new driver's licence stop orders initiative been in collecting unpaid traffic fines during its first year?
And that's the former Mayor of Palmerston North, John O'Naylor, now a National List MP and backbencher with the job of asking Patsy questions, such as that one to the Minister for Courts, Amy Adams.
Mr. Speaker.
Honourable Amy Adams.
Mr. Speaker, last February this government introduced driver's licence stop orders. These give the courts the power to...
And that's all we have time for this week. Parliament's in a short adjournment back on Tuesday, March the 10th at 2 p.m. Meantime, you can find lots more information and a podcast of this programme on our webpage, parliamenttoday or oneword.co.nz. I'm Hanaya Ahu and I'll be back with Tom Fruin and Rhys Lyon and another report from Parliament at the same time next week.